So I'm delighted to introduce Peter Zakhar, who's a professor of psychology at the Open University of Montgomery. But most relevantly for today is his comparatively recent book, A Metaphysics of Psychopathology. I like to think that to some extent today is partly his fault. We're going to have roughly half an hour of talk, and then 15 minutes of questions, and then Rachel's going to do half an hour of talk and 15 minutes of questions, and then there's 15 minutes in the schedule for final reflection, was it? More questions, reflections, words of wisdom, that sort of thing. So, over to you, Peter.
Thank you, Tim. I'd like to begin by thanking Rachel for inviting me to be with you here today. It's always just a massive treat for me to come to the UK, and this is my first trip to Lancaster, and hopefully it won't be my last. So I'd like to begin, there are many different grades and interpretations of pragmatism, and I'd like to begin my explication of one kind of pragmatist metaphysics by looking at some of the things it takes from empiricism, and specifically the nominalism of John Locke, which he described in book 3 of his essay Concerning Human Understanding. So commitment to obscure concepts can lead intelligent people to enthusiastically believe ill-advised, senseless things. When historians such as Woolhouse try to understand Locke's motivation for beginning to compose the essay, they look to his generation's reactions to the English Civil War and its aftermath. And in particularly Locke and many of his contemporaries formed an objection to what they call religious enthusiasm or enthusiasm. And what they meant by enthusiasm was people's certainty that their actions were in accord with divine revelation. And so part of the problem here is that people are prone to uncritically commit to abstract concepts, and intellectuals are particularly vulnerable to this. Now, in the process of conceptual abstraction, particulars are dropped out. Now, this isn't a new idea. The Aristotelians believe something very similar to this. But you can take it a little further and say the more remote the abstraction gets from particulars, the more obscure it becomes. And this is particularly problematic when the abstract concept is defined in terms of other abstract concepts, such as truth is correspondence with reality, or facts are things that are objectively true. And so one of the key features of sort of nominalists is that they tend to believe that abstract concepts can get too disconnected from particulars. And so emphasizing experience, as Locke does, is a strategy for making abstract concepts less obscure. But reasoning also matters for Locke. And with respect to reasoning, Locke means, you know, thinking for yourself. But it's also when he talks about reasoning, he also talks about reasoning that takes into account how human understanding occurs and its limits. And we're going to see that the pragmatists will adopt a similar strategy when they talk about the concept of truth. So also influential for pragmatists is Locke's critique of essences and substances. And this is sort of related to the nominalism. One of the ways to think about an essence is it's a nature that is equally present in every member of a kind. And that definition of essences works for Aristotelian universals as well as Boyle's microstructural essences. And Locke rejects classification by real essences because he believes that real essences are unknowable. And so to focus on nominal essences in the way Locke does is to think in terms of property clusters and to be more inclined to notice variation. And this, in a really important way, this anticipates pragmatism. So another thing Locke says is species, which is his term, we use the term kinds now. That's what he meant by a species. Species are concepts specifying what individual members share in common. And Locke uses this word, they're the workmanship of the human understanding. And he says something very, I think, very interesting and important for his view, which he claims that essences are properties of a species. They're never properties of an individual. So that means, in a sense, for him, essences are concepts that we use to group things together. And so for Locke, in a certain way, classifications are made by us. Not necessarily made up by us, but made by us. That's what I wanted to say about that. Those are some of the things that the pragmatists take from Locke, and I'll talk more about how they do that. Obviously, to look at its roots in empiricism, we could talk about what they take from Hume, what we take from Mill, but I think it's good to focus on Locke, because some of these Lockean themes are often sort of like ignored in explicating sort of pragmatism. So the second thing I want to talk about is, with respect to pragmatist metaphysics, is its basis in Darwin's theory of natural selection. And sort of in the book, for me, pragmatism is what happens when empiricism meets Darwin. So many supporters of Darwin did not accept his 1859 theory of evolution completely. This would include Huxley, Lyell, and even Wallace. Really, scientists in general did not accept that natural selection is the primary mechanism in evolution until the 1940s. When Darwin died in 1882, not very many people talked about it. And by the beginning of the 20th century, natural selection was considered unimportant relative to something like mutation. But the early pragmatists, and here's a picture of Peirce and then a young James, these guys were in college just after 1859. So they were the first generation to encounter natural selection in their formative years, and they readily accepted it. And just as Locke and his generation came of age in opposition to the enthusiasm of the English Civil War, James and some of his contemporaries came of age in opposition to what they saw as the static and rigid absolutes that were fueling the American Civil War. And natural selection gave them something different. Things are in flux. So natural selection inspires pragmatism, a theory about the meaning of abstract concepts such as truth. I think it's important when we see phrases like "it's true because it works" is to understand that that's a slogan, just like the survival of the fittest is a slogan. It's not the theory. The theory is, what they do is they locate the meaning of truth in an understanding of how it is that human understanding goes about selecting which statements to accept as true. And there's a kind of a Baconian emphasis to the pragmatists, where they believe in the importance of trying things out and experimenting, as opposed to just learning from books. Now, they're not opposed to learning from books, but they also understand the flaws of just learning from books. You have to get out there in the world and do stuff. So for the pragmatist, then, beliefs are tools for adaptation. If we can successfully act on a belief, then the belief is more likely to be selected for future use. And if so, we call it true. I think what I want to say about that is, one of the things people maybe do when they see something like that is they think of pragmatism as advocating for short-term utilitarianism or expediency or convenience. And James is partly responsible for this, because he uses expedient to describe their notion of truth. And here's where you have to understand the background. Natural selection is about what happens over the long term, the very long term, and so is pragmatism. It's what we select as true over a very long period of time, not for today and not for short-term convenience. And then, so the metaphysics of pragmatism was labeled radical empiricism by James. And just as an interesting aside, Bas von Frassen argues that James was one of the first people to self-employ the term empiricist, or to describe his philosophy as empiricism. Locke would have considered empiric a term of derision. And actually, my understanding is Mill would have done the same for empiricism. They both thought of it as a kind of an anti-intellectual opposition to theory. But in the late 19th century, sort of the meaning of the term slightly shifts. James isn't the only one, but the meaning of the term slightly shifts. But so for James's radical empiricism, what he means is experience rests on nothing but itself. Concepts such as the reality beyond our experience, or that which is mind independent, are themselves parts of experience. So earlier I mentioned their opposition to the rigid and static absolutes that fueled the American Civil War. In James, this becomes a kind of anti-transcendental philosophy. And the upshot is that for concepts like that which is mind dependent, metaphysical concepts like that, mind independent, for James is we don't need to reject these things, but we need to understand their role internal to experience. We need to understand them as parts of experience. Also important for the pragmatist is Darwin's view that species do not have essences. Rather, they are populations of individuals that vary. So Locke, nominal essences and variation. Locke thought we have to think of kinds this way due to the limits of human reason. Darwin takes a little bit further, and he says, no, this is actually what some kinds of kinds are really like. You know, they really are just populations of individuals that vary. And so pragmatists believe that we cannot divest ourselves of all metaphysical assumptions. We can select one or two for critical analysis, but not suspend all metaphysics at once. So according to the pragmatist, there's no going back to a primordial beginning starting point, and there's no transcending it all into some sort of platonic realm of what's really there. They say we are in the middle. We're in the middle of things. We can't start at the beginning. We can't get beyond it. And so the process of knowledge is ongoing, imperfect, and coddled together in the same way that species are evolving imperfect and coddled together, is how they think about it. Anyway, these ideas likely reflect some of the basic intuitions that make deflationary metaphysics attractive to a lot of people. And so metaphysics, of course, in the late 20th century gets very technical, and I'm not doing anything technical today, but at the very least, with respect to deflationary metaphysics, I think you can say that James clearly anticipated those philosophers who argue that metaphysical disputes are largely verbal disputes. So with that background in place, let me talk a little bit about what I presented in A Metaphysics of Psychopathology. And I did call it A Metaphysics. The MIT Press, we were working over titles, they wanted to call it The Metaphysics. I said, no, let's call it A. One of the things I argue in the book is that metaphysical abstractions are treated as self-evident, but they're often obscure. And concepts I look at in the book include real, natural kind, objective dysfunction, true disorder. Actually, I think the concepts that of reality, truth, objectivity, and fact, those are the concepts that everyone thinks they understand. And they're really fundamental concepts, and they're the ones that can really be obscure. In many ways, those are some of the important ones. So sometimes obscure concepts are used as statements of sentiment. So, you should accept the Copernican theory because it is true. I got this idea from Arthur Fine's work on the natural ontological attitude. And what Fine says is, he says, a lot of times metaphysical assertions are verbal complements of a stomping of the foot on the ground or the thumping of a hand on the desk. And what Flynn's looking at is he's looking at these debates between scientific realists and anti-realists, and he says, look, if you look at the realists and the anti-realists, they accept the same basic claims of the scientists and for the same basic reasons. And so the metaphysical arguments they get into are elaborations that can be dispensed with. And so I think at the very least, this very much ties into what Rachel's theme of Rachel's conference today, but you know, at the very least, I think there's a lot of foot stomping and death stomping in the philosophy of psychiatry. Often, other times, concepts are obscure by being defined in terms of each other. So truth is correspondence with reality, or facts are things that are objectively true. In the book, I talk about example of the young philosopher who's very, very good with abstract concepts and words, and they just flow out of her or him. And if they ever encounter someone who's not a philosopher and that person asks them, I don't understand what you mean by this, what you see is one abstract concept is defined in terms of another abstract concept that the person doesn't understand. And if they then say, well, I don't understand what that is, and then they find it, that define it in terms of another abstract concept, eventually they get back to the original concept, you know, that the person didn't understand. And so there's a notion they never get to anything particular. And you get this sense that it's just words about words. And to some extent, you know, we all do that. I know I do. But here's the thing though. So we can be deflationary about metaphysics. But the thing about the book is, in psychiatry, whether something such as post-traumatic stress disorder is real is important socially and personally. So these Vietnam vets who came back from the war in the early 1970s, you know, they started experiencing debilitating problems after the war ended, 6 months or a year after the war had ended. And it was extremely important for them that the VA hospital and psychiatry recognized PTSD as something real and not just an expression of depression or an expression of a pre-existing personality disorder, or more lingering. So in philosophy of psychiatry, these metaphysical questions about reality and unreality are so much more than just academic. And then throughout the book, I try to make concepts less obscure in various ways. Now, the question is, would some of my key claims have been proposed without the metaphysical assumptions I employ? And let me talk about those assumptions, and on a certain level I'm going to say, well, I probably wouldn't have made the claims without the metaphysical assumptions. So that's the first thing. I'm going to talk about some of the claims that I wouldn't have made without the metaphysical assumptions. And these would be four key assumptions. What things are like is sometimes different than how we want them to be or how we believe that they are, which in the book I call basic realism, which, by the way, this is my attempt also to say, how does the concept of mind-independent work internal to experience? It works this way. We all know that there are things that are not always the way we want them to be, and we know that things are not always the way we think they are, and that's probably our experiential root of the concept of the objective. Historically, another assumption, as concepts become increasingly abstract and focus on what things share, they lose sight of the variability that is there, which is, you know, aspects of nominalism. Correspondence to reality is not an all-purpose, workable criterion for seeking true statements. Coherence is important. That's aspect of pragmatism. And psychiatric kinds do not have essences that can form the basis of a privileged, all-purpose classification. Non-essentialism, and historically, that's where it all begins for me. So here's the first question, then. Would I have defined the imperfect community model like I do? The imperfect community is a concept from Nelson Goodman. And Goodman uses it to refer to a set that has members that are alike in various ways, but there's no one way in which they are all alike. And I apply that to the domain of psychiatry and say, it's an imperfect community. That our entryway into psychiatry was probably psychotic states, which almost everybody would agree are sort of problematic and disorders. And then what happens is there's all these other psychotic, what happens is in the 19th century particularly, a range of non-psychotic states that resembled the psychoses in various ways were added into the domain. So you have symptoms like these. You know, so for example, agitation, anger, and excitement is a symptom you see in some psychotic states, but then you also had people with problematic agitation, anger, and excitement, and they weren't psychotic because it resembled the psychotic states that the alienists were treating in various and sundry ways, it's added into the domain. And what you end up with is a set of states that are alike in many ways, but there's no one way in which they're all alike. That's how the domain was built up. It's an imperfect community. And then in the book, I argue, look, we should expect and hope for progress in psychiatric classification, but that progress will not include eliminating the imperfect community structure of the domain. And so I'm sure I said that. That's my nominalism. That's the a world of particulars that are alike in various ways, in various ways. I'm sure that's what brought me to that. Would I have privileged natural kinds more than I do? Here's what I think about natural kinds. So what I've come to over the years, and this is one of the things I've been thinking about, you know, probably for a long time. Natural kinds is a cluster concept, and it includes various features. This is kind of a nominalist analysis of the concept of natural kind, breaking it down into its components. Naturally occurring, supporting induction, causally produced, subject to the authority of science. And now this would be my list of my breakdown of natural kinds as a non-essentialist concept. If you want to think about natural kinds as things with essences, the list gets a lot longer. I think this is probably historically a better way to go anyway. Probably historically we can trace the concept of natural kind to John Stuart Mill, and it was Mill's attempt to have a way of having natural classifications without essences. He called them natural categories, and then afterwards his followers started calling them natural kinds. Anyway, so one thing I say is, look, here's our global concept of natural kind, but some of these things, like for classification, supporting induction, Rachel's, being causally produced, these are perfectly good things on which to base a classification. And we can use these, but we don't necessarily have to understand them under the auspices of the obscure concept of natural kinds with all its metaphysical baggage. So that's my more eliminativist, you know, eliminate natural kinds, eliminativist nominalism. But then I have another, I came to something different. And this idea is that, look, the concept of natural kind is a tool. It's a concept that we use, and we use it, it provides certain information about the world. It reveals information about the world that other concepts maybe don't reveal. But one of the ways you understand an abstract concept like natural kind is to understand some of its contrasts. So you can understand it as natural kind versus historical construct, natural kind versus normative concept, natural kind versus practical kind. So a historical construct is, you know, things, it's this idea that things come into being and go away, or they change over time, or they vary across cultures. An example would be, depression's a good one. It would be like the difference between the interiorized, guilt-ridden, anhedonic depression of the Western world, England and the United States and Germany, versus the depression as it exists in the developing world and in China, which is, it's a somatic condition. It involves headaches and back pains and stomach aches. Right? So things vary. A normative concept, Rachel, I think, is going to talk about this later on. There are norms involved in deciding that something's a disorder. Like, so for example, that they're like weeds. Derek's also excellent on this, but with respect to normative concepts, just if you think about symptoms, even to call a symptom exaggerated or deficient or inappropriate requires norms. And then practical kinds is this pragmatist idea that in developing classifications, we have goals for classifying. And sometimes what we need to do is we need to sort of find some balance between the goals, and our construct becomes a compromise between competing goals. So for example, in the DSM, many of those constructs would be, say, a compromise between the goal of increasing inter-rater reliability and reducing stigma. And I probably would not have said this without my nominalist and anti-essentialist assumptions. So, would I have described scientific progress as achieving competitive superiority with respect to accepted standards of adequacy or goals? Okay, I'm running short on time. Look, this is my pragmatist idea that in classification we have goals or standards about what counts as a good classification. We try to achieve as many of these as possible. So this is similar to Kuhn's notion of norms for good theories. Some recent standards for psychiatric classification that have been proposed is having a genetic, anatomical, or physiological basis, being a homogeneous latent variable, being measured reliably, spanning the normal and the abnormal, predicting time course and outcome, and supporting improvement in clinical treatment and management. So in a sense, all these goals are currently being used to develop psychiatric classifications, and they're trying to find some balance between them where they can achieve as many of them as possible. And so what I say is, look, standards can be specified in such a way that they can be objectively met, and progress occurs when we can know or do something impossible, even unimagined, from the perspective of an earlier generation. Now, the question is, where does this come from? This comes from my colleague Kenneth Kendler started writing about epistemic iteration as how we move from imperfect constructs to slowly approximating reality with small gradual improvements. And he got that idea from Hasek Chang, but he interpreted it in a kind of a correspondence with reality, scientific realist way. And so I came up with this calibration idea because I wanted to say, yeah, but can we have a concept of progress without correspondence with reality? So I probably wouldn't have done this if I had said correspondence with reality is an all-purpose a definition of truth. Okay, so could I have gotten to these positions without my metaphysical assumptions? And my answer is, let me just talk about one because I'm running out of time. This is the good one anyway. Let's take the imperfect community model. Could I have gotten there without, so I'm not sure if, I think you always have to have some metaphysical assumptions, I would think, and you should probably be aware of what they are. But as far as the imperfect community model, I could have probably gotten there as a scientific realist, because there's a sort of inconsistency in my position where I say that there's a part of me that says the psychiatric domain is structured like an imperfect community. And people don't see it because either they lack experience with the domain or they're using inappropriate essentialist assumptions and an essentialist bias, so they don't see it. And they see it as more potentially defined than it is. So I could have gotten there as a scientific realist, I think. As far as the other two, let me just briefly say, I can do it in a minute. With both of these other two, like what I say about natural kinds as a concept that we use, it's just a concept that reveals certain things about disorders and hides certain things about disorders, or about coherence, I probably could have gotten there too, but what I have to say is, look, these are short-term, these are not our long-term goals. Right now, because of the way classification is, we have to understand that they're kind of practical kinds, and they're kind of compromises, and they're not natural kinds right now, and they have a historical dimension, and coherence is probably a good clue to truth, but in the long term, what we want to get to as the correct absolute privileged classification of psychiatric disorders. But in the short term, since we're not there, we need to use sort of coherence and all these other concepts. I probably could have gotten there as well. Probably the difference is between me and that kind of scientific realist is we disagree about what the long-term endpoint is going to be. And I say their goal is probably completely unrealistic.